This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Police departments around the country have come under intense scrutiny after the rash of fatal encounters between police and citizens, African-American males in particular. Those departments know they have a problem, and many, including CMPD, have instituted changes in policy and procedures. Even before we experienced what seemed like a nightly parade of violent police encounters on TV, the Washington Post had embarked on an investigative reporting project looking into and tracking fatal police shootings. It won the paper the Pulitzer Prize. Their efforts continued into late last year, and I believe continued today, and concluded that despite ongoing national scrutiny of police tactics, the number of fatal shootings by officers in 2016 remained virtually unchanged from the previous year, when nearly 1,000 people were killed by police across the country. One of the reporters working on that investigation for the Post was Wesley Lowry, a national reporter for the paper. He covers the interactions between law enforcement officials and communities and has written a book about his experiences called They Can't Kill Us All. It is described as the first deeply reported book to bring alive the quest for justice in the deaths of Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and Freddie Gray. And Wesley Lowry joins us now for the hour from Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Later on in the program, we're going to be bringing in Charlotteans responsible for an exhibit called No Justice, No Peace at the Levine Museum of the New South. The word no, by the way, is spelled K-N-O-W. And Wesley Lowry will be signing his book and participating in a discussion on the topic for the museum on March 2nd at the Duke Energy Theater here at Spirit Square. Wesley, we talked about this Washington Post study back in September with one of your colleagues, Kimbrel Kelly, who also worked on this story for the Post, and we asked about how and why the paper decided to devote its resources to uncovering data on fatal police shootings. So remind us, how and why did this start?
Of course. So this was a project that really, as many journalistic projects do, grew out of our daily coverage. You know, so I was one of our reporters back in 2014 who covered the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, the protest as well as at times riots after the death of Michael Brown and the shooting by Ferguson police officer Derek Wilson. And as we were reporting and covering this story, I would be doing all these interviews. I'd interview some residents and protesters and activists, and then I'd go, and what they would say is that, you know, this is a crisis. That it's not just about Michael Brown, but rather that unarmed black men are being executed every day in the streets. And then we would call the police and the police unions and groups who might be more sympathetic to officers, and they would say, no, this is not a crisis. People aren't being killed every day. In fact, most officers never even draw their weapons. Police shootings are hyper-rare. And I would send these articles back to my editors at D.C., and them being smart editors would say, well, which of those things is true? Because they both can't be. Can we look at the data? You know, can the police department tell us how many people have been killed? Can the Secretary of State of Missouri tell us how many people have been killed by police in the state, right? And then who has the federal information? And what we were shocked to find out as we began to apply pressure to this was that there was no uniform, readily available national statistics as it related to who was killed by the police and under what circumstances. That the only statistics that existed for the most part, you had a few kind of crowd-funded efforts to do this, and then you had a statistic that was put out by the FBI every year that was a voluntary self-reporting process. And according to that number, there were about 460 fatal shootings a year. So what we decided to do is we decided to mimic and to learn from the crowdsourcing efforts and to begin setting up a system where we would ourselves in real time track fatal police shootings. Now, what we did is you can't really rely on public records here because many police departments will refuse to give you any information in real time. But the best way to do this is, in fact, to track media reports, because if someone is killed, whether it be in the largest market or the smallest market, someone in the media is going to write about it at least once. And once you know that a death has existed, you can go back to the police. And so what we did was we would check every single day. We would set up Google alerts. We would do customized searches. And we would track in a database every fatal police shooting we could confirm. By the end of our first year, end of 2015, we had tracked and confirmed 991 fatal police shootings in the year prior. So more than twice as many as the federal government was saying were happening. And now we are able to do kind of a high-end analysis that told us, you know, what should we actually know about police fatal force, as opposed to, you know, kind of having this conversation in a world of kind of anecdote and conjecture. We now had some data and some information.
And I understand it was you, if not you, among other people, who encouraged the Post to begin assembling this database of shootings around the country. How do you explain that the federal government, that the FBI, does not have an accurate number and does not seem to want to have an accurate number?
It's a unique, and it's true that, you know, I was one of our kind of driving forces on this. I say often that one of the reasons I love working at the Post is that I can come up with a crazy idea and then people way more talented than I can actually execute the idea. But it was stunning to me. And it's one of the reasons I pushed and advocated for this pretty adamantly, is because it, you know, especially kind of being a journalist and reporter, you know, we're all kind of sunlight transparency types. And so I'm imagining that there should be a file cabinet somewhere with a manila envelope for every single, you know, police fatal use of force. And that, me as a taxpayer, I should have the right to go examine all of them, right? But in reality, because of the way policing operates in this country, and we are unique among major world powers in how we police, and this goes back to a, you know, founding fathers federalism debate, right, that police departments in the United States of America, there are somewhere between 18 and 19,000 of them, essentially operate as individual fiefdoms, right? We do not have federally standardized policing. We do not, your sheriff or your police chief essentially gets to decide how his officers or deputies are trained. They get to decide what information they release or they do not release. Now, theoretically, at a local level, either through a city council ordinance or the directive of a mayor, there's room for those things to be changed and influenced. But again, policing is a local government issue. And so because of that, the FBI, and this applies not only to fatal use of police force, it also applies to things such as our national murder rate, right? These are all kind of guesstimates by the FBI based on voluntary self-reporting. And so, for example, what we saw in the fatal use of force statistics is that you had entire states that where not a single department was reporting killing anyone over periods of years. Now, we knew that wasn't true, right? We know that it's untrue that in the last decade, not a single person has been killed by the police in Florida, for example. That can't be true. We know that when we look at the 2014 numbers and Tamir Rice is missing from the database, you know, this case that everyone has talked about in Cleveland because the Cleveland police never reported his death to the FBI. I think that again, it was confounding to most of us. And it wasn't about any particular agenda. One of the things that I'm proud of with this project is that, you know, it's been praised widely not only by civil rights groups and activists, but the, you know, National Fraternal Order of Police cites our statistics constantly. Groups of police chiefs and policing think tanks use our information. This idea that to have smarter policing, we have to actually have information about what is happening, what is not. How can we? Everyone wants to live in a world where the police are killing fewer people. The police would like to live in that world. Certainly residents would like to live in that world. The civil rights community would like to live in that world. But how do you start to create that world if we don't even know who is being killed by police and under what circumstance?
I want to back up to this fact that you reported that Tamir Rice's shooting by the Cleveland police was not reported to the FBI and therefore it wasn't in the FBI's records. Why wasn't it reported? Because they don't have to, because they didn't want to, because they wanted to cover it up. I mean, it was in all the papers. It was on television every day.
Yeah. And so I would lean away from, you know, a cover up in that, you know, essentially, I think that most likely it's because, and I don't know, I'm not inside the minds of the heads of the police, right? But, and that's my hometown, Cleveland. But, It's that these are voluntary reports, right? A local police department does not have to tell the FBI how many people are killed in their jurisdiction, what percentage of their crimes they solve, or who they kill. You know, these are all voluntary reports that the FBI, you know, once or twice a year says, hey, can you let us know? And some departments cooperate fully, some departments cooperate kind of, some don't really at all. And so, it really strikes a blow to the credibility of a lot of the federal justice data that we have, because the FBI and the Department of Justice are not actually capable of compelling any of these departments to release not only accurate information, but in some cases, any information at all. And again, that is crippling as it relates to trying to find policy solutions or potential tactical reforms, because if you don't actually have an accurate set of information, how can you even begin to go about doing it?
So how far back does your research, does your database go? Because we all know, we can make the leap that these things have been going on forever, for hundreds of years, and perhaps only it was the advent of social media and camera phones and dash cams and body cams that really has brought this out into the spotlight full and front and center for a couple of years now. So how far back do you go? How long has this been going on?
So we are now in our third year, and so we begin with 2015.
Okay.
And because this is something we published in real time. So that was the thing. We didn't collect this data and then publish it. We would multiple times a week, at least once a week, update in real time that as of this date, we know of this many fatal shootings so far this year, right? And so we have a full data set for 2015, a full data set for 2016, and we are continuing this year in real time to update. I believe we're up over 150 or somewhere around 150 fatal police shootings nationally so far this year.
So the last report that I saw was that the Post reported in 2016 that despite ongoing national scrutiny of police tactics, the number of fatal shootings by officers was outpacing 2015 through July. But then it ended the year slightly lower. 957 people were killed last year as opposed to 991 in 2015. And I believe this is as of yesterday, February 21st, 151 people have been fatally shot by police this year nationwide. Does that put this year on track to equal last year, be less than last year, greater than last year?
We're on track to be a little bit up from last year. Now, again, it's difficult because currently we're only 2 months into the year, right? And so, you're talking about a world where you could all of a sudden, March could be a month where miraculously no one is killed or vice versa, right? There's still some time this year, but currently we are on track to slide in probably somewhere between the 990 of 2015 and the 950-something of last year. Again, what we're finding is that consistently we're talking about 2.5 to 3.5 people who are killed, 2 to 3 people being fatally shot by the police every single day, and that being consistent now over what will end up being a 3-year period.
So we have about a minute left in this segment. So I want to ask you, I know you're keeping this running tally, but does your database reveal the circumstances surrounding those shootings? Do we know how many people were unquestionably justified, how many would fall into the category of the most egregious abuses of power and bad judgment that we've sometimes seen in the past?
So we do know the circumstances. Now, one thing we take pains to go to is we attempt to avoid any conversation of justification or not, in part because there's a layer of subjectivity there. Mm-hmm. But what we know is that the vast majority of people who are killed by police are, in fact, armed with a weapon, most likely a gun. And in many cases, they are attacking the officer or attacking someone else. Now, one of the chief limits, now we do know of hundreds of cases, usually between 200 and 300 cases a year, about a third of them, where either the person is completely unarmed, is largely unarmed, perhaps what the officer is claiming is that a vehicle is the weapon, for example.
Let me stop you, Wesley, because we have to take a break. We'll come back and get the rest of that answer in a moment. Wesley Lowery from The Washington Post on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Beckner Museum of Modern Art, presenting guest lecture by Dr. Pepe Carmel on alternative histories of abstract art in the Beckler Collection, Saturday, February 25th at 6 p.m. Tickets at beckler.org. President Trump has made it clear that he loathes the press. He has called out individual reporters, chastising them for being dishonest, and he's castigated the media at large for being the enemy of the American people. He has told the media the public doesn't believe you anymore. So, is this hostility something totally new? Have the media, in fact, lost credibility? Or is this an effective diversionary tactic? We will talk about that on this morning, on this program tomorrow morning at 9.
I'm Anthony Brooks, coming up on the next On Point. New guidelines from the Trump administration give more power to U.S. officials to deport undocumented immigrants. The new tough rules are causing alarm and fear in immigrant communities. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are talking to Wesley Lowery, who is a national reporter for The Washington Post, involved in the stories they've been printing over the years on police shootings around the country, and in one of the instigators of the Post's establishment of a database to keep track of these shootings by police. He's also the author of his own book called They Can't Kill Us All, which chronicles his experiences covering all of this for the newspaper. I asked you about the database and whether it's just numbers or whether there's some qualitative behind those numbers, and you were in the middle of an answer that I had to stop you on, Wesley. Go ahead and finish your answer to that question.
Yeah, no worries. So again, the top line here is that, and you know, we've tracked now somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 fatal police shootings since the beginning of 2015. The vast majority of these shootings are of people who are armed, many of whom, most of whom, armed with guns, in somewhere between, you know, 400 and 600 of these cases, you're talking about someone who is either completely unarmed or perhaps is in a vehicle. So the officer is claiming the vehicle is being used as a weapon. What we've seen is that sometimes that is true, sometimes that is not. But what we've seen, and you know, we try to speak to this question very often, is the limitation of our data is that, and that's a limitation of the public knowledge broadly in these shootings, is that you have an interaction very often between two people. One person is dead. The other person is attempting to prevent themselves from losing their job and going to jail. And so we know that we have a built-in bias even in our analysis of what we know. And the other thing, and this was a major lesson of 2016, of year two of our project, was that the assumption that we all make very often is, and because of the question we want to know the answer to, well, were these justified? Are the majority of them, you know, good shootings or bad shootings, or you know, the worst cases or gray areas? What's difficult is that while the majority of cases involve someone armed with a gun, we live in a country where many people legally own firearms, where there are tens of millions of firearms. And what we saw in specific cases last year were cases where a gun was present, where in the past perhaps we would have immediately marked that it must be a justified shooting, but then video evidence began to raise questions about whether or not that was a fair conclusion. So Philando Castillo in Minnesota is an example of this. Someone who has a concealed carry permit is pulled over during a traffic stop, and then video evidence and audio evidence, now the officer's been charged, seems to suggest that this man, who is armed with a gun, behaved exactly as he was supposed to, told the officer he was armed, that he had this gun legally, that the officer either overreacted or got frightened and pulled the trigger and killed someone, right? Now, that's a case where, minus the video evidence, we would throw that in the clearly justified case. See, that guy had a gun, right? And the officer says he pulled it on him. And so that's one of the things that complicates this, is that the preponderance of video evidence has not shown us that even more cases than we thought are clearly justified. In fact, it's raised questions about cases that we otherwise would have assumed justified.
Most of the discussion that is centered on the shootings around the country have been shootings of black males armed and unarmed by police. Mm-hmm. But the Post discovered that white males continue to be those most often killed, accounting for 46% of deaths in 2016. That, on the surface, that sounds like a shocking fact, but it's not. And explain why. There are more of us.
Something to the tune of 20 to 30 million more. and so it becomes this, which is just kind of a funny, you know, I think about, like, oh, 30 million more white people. Wow. That in reality, when you start looking at these statistics, right, in a nation that is majority white, and majority white by no short measure, it only makes sense that if this is something that was evenly distributed across the population, right, as crime is relatively evenly, you know, that there's this real question of course there should be some racial disparity as it relates to more white people being killed if these are things that get evenly distributed, right? Now, what we did find is that while in raw number, white men are certainly the most likely to be killed by the police, who are being killed by police most often, that when you look at percentages of the population, there you do start to see these racial disparities, and a specific racial disparity as it relates to Black Americans, right? Where black men represent 6% of the population in the United States of America, and yet they make up something about 24% of the unarmed people who are shot and killed by the police. And one of the reasons we focus specifically on unarmed there is because it starts to drill into this idea beyond criminality and criminals. And, you know, you're not talking about a murderer typically when you're talking about an unarmed person who is shot and killed by the police. You're not talking about, a bank robber, right? You're talking about situations that are very often toss-ups. Someone who has run, someone perhaps who's believed to have drugs, someone who's maybe gotten in a fight, or, you know, you're not talking about your worst of the worst of your universe. You're talking about people who have no weapon with them and very likely have not committed some major crime, right? And so that also opens the door. We've had some academics who've come back and analyzed and interrogated our data after us, and that is something they focused on as well. And what they just recently republished their analysis, and one of the things they focused on specifically was this idea that when the assessing the threat level, what the person was doing at the time when they were killed, that a black person killed by the police, and specifically an unarmed black person killed by the police, was no more likely to have been attacking a police officer or attacking someone else when they were killed. In fact, they were just slightly less likely, right? That this argument that, in fact, a white person, even though there are more of them being killed by the police, has to do more to get themselves killed by the police than a person of color does, that begins to raise this question and the specter of, is there an implicit bias? Is there something about the way that we as a society view men of color, specifically black men, that may lead us to believe that that cell phone is a gun when it's really a cell phone, or may lead us to believe that the man telling us calmly, hey, I've got a concealed carry permit, thrust us into panic and we pull the trigger? That, I think, and that's something that we're continuing to probe and look into, is to what extent can these disparities be contributed to implicit biases that we all carry about of people.
Your reporting does reveal, however, that there has been an increase in prosecutions of officers involved in fatal shootings in the 2 years since Ferguson occurred. Is this because of the increased talk about this in the media, because of increased coverage in the media? Is it because of the availability of bystander cell phone video that pretty much makes people see things that they've never seen before because of riots? Why are we prosecuting more officers now?
So we think it's a cocktail of things. So first I'll walk through kind of the basics of what we know. So one of the first pieces that we did, my colleagues Kimberly Kindy and Kimberly L. Kelly, did a piece where they analyzed 10 years of prosecutions of officers in fatal shootings. We went back to 2005 through 2014 and looked at every case in which an officer was charged with a crime for a fatal on-duty shooting. And what we found essentially was that there were about 5 of these a year. There were 64 of them between 2005 and 2014. What happened in the year after Ferguson, starting in 2015, is we saw a skyrocketing number of these. I believe we had 18 prosecutions in 2015, and then 13 prosecutions in 2016. And so a tripling of the number of officers being charged. Now, why? This cuts in a few different directions. It is certainly true that there was a new and different political pressure and media scrutiny of these decisions than ever before. Just 2 years or 3 years earlier, the chances that a reporter like me is calling the prosecutor's office every day and saying, hey, have you decided if you're charging that cop in that shooting yet, was something that probably was not happening. There were certainly the rare cases that became more prominent, but the reality is there was less of a pressure and a less of a scrutiny of prosecutors and grand juries than there had been prior to Ferguson, and now there was more of one. But the other thing that we saw is that there is a preponderance and an increase in availability of video evidence in a way that had not existed previously. Again, if you start looking at the individual cases where officers were charged, Walter Scott in North Charleston, or Anthony Hill in Atlanta, Corey Jones in Florida, almost all of these cases involve, Sam DuBose in Cincinnati, almost all of these cases involve video or audio evidence that maybe just 1 year earlier would not have existed, or 2 years earlier would not have existed. And that in the absence of that video evidence, that the officer's word would have been believed completely, and there's no way that officer would have been charged. So I think there's two things there. The first is that it is certainly true that more officers are being charged in connection to these shootings, and that, in fact, our impression, the more information we have about these shootings, as I said earlier, the larger the list of shootings that appear bad are. We are not, because of video, now realizing, in fact, that even fewer of them are controversial than before. We are only finding additional ones that previously we would have thought were not controversial. But on top of that, it is still important to remember that even with a market increase, even 18 of the 990 shootings of 2015 is still less than 1%, right? The vast majority of cases, officers are not being charged in these shootings. And you can, depending on how you would like to use that statistic, you could interpret that in one of two ways. Either clearly all of these are legally justified shootings, and why is everyone upset about this? Or you can argue that maybe perhaps more people should be prosecuted, more of these officers should be prosecuted, or at the very least, that we have a system that is not structured to prosecute police officers. And I think that's kind of where I land, is that we have a system, we as a country allot a lot of leeway to our police officers, who we ask to be in very tough positions every single day. And because of that, we do not have a system that in a gray area, in a toss-up, our benefit of the doubt leans towards the officer. And so because of that, it is in fact very difficult for an officer to do something on duty as it relates to fatal force that is going to result in them being charged with a crime.
So you have been covering the aftermath of these shootings around the country for the Washington Post for several years now, and now you have come out with your own book on this topic, from your own experiences, called They Can't Kill Us. I have not had access to that book, so I don't know what's in it, but what is in that book that is different from what you have factually reported in the newspaper?
Of course. So the book is an attempt to do two different things, right? First of all, it's written in a more of a first person about covering these issues. But second, the book also seeks to explain and kind of comprehend the broad Black Lives Matter protest and movement that burst onto the scene in 2013, 2014, and that really propelled forward this conversation, right? And so what the book seeks to do is not only lay out our statistical and our data information, which we had done by the time I even began working on the book, but in addition to that context, it begins to tell the stories of who were these, in many cases, young people who were on the kind of front lines of forcing this issue in recent years, and also who were some of these families and people who were killed in some of these controversial cases, right? And so it's profiles of people like Bree Newsom, who took the Confederate flag down after the Emanuel AME church shootings, or profiles of people like Doreen McKesson or Janetta Elzey or Brittany Packnett, all activists who were prominent in both St. Louis and then in Baltimore and elsewhere, right? And telling the stories of who are these people. One of the reasons I did that was because as someone who was traveling the country covering these stories, in city after city I would meet these very often young people, but also a mix of folks, no matter who they were. I would meet them and I would interact with them, and I would see the reasons why a given individual might be in the street. So for someone like Janetta Elzey, who's one of the first people in the book from Ferguson, she in fact had a friend prior to Michael Brown who'd been killed by the police. And so when she saw this death and this killing, it kind of in many ways triggered a recollection of her emotions and her feelings from when her friend had been killed. And she remembered specifically the media coverage. She had read all the comments, which you're never supposed to do, but she'd read all the comments on every article about her slain friend and all the people calling him a thug and he deserved it. And she was infuriated. And so she said, you know what, I'm going to go out in the street because I don't want this to happen to someone else. Someone like Doreen McKesson, who is prominent in Baltimore specifically, who had been an educator, and who has this moment of realization. He's sitting in a classroom in Minneapolis and watching the protest in Ferguson. He realizes his whole career has been based on teaching young people, but it doesn't really matter if he teaches them, if those young people can't walk home safely or are being killed in the streets, right? And so I think it's important. Sometimes, you know, I get a lot of reader email and phone calls and people who are who say, I don't understand it. I don't get it. Why are 10,000 people in my streets right now? Why are people so upset? Why can't everyone wait? Why can't they figure it out? And what I tell those readers is that I think we make a mistake when we attempt to look at a protest, look at a group of people, look at 10,000 people, and understand them as a group, as a collective. I think what the smarter way into that, or the way that actually helps you understand, is to, can I understand why one of these people came out? Can I understand what Janetta, can I understand DeRay, can I understand Brittany in a way that I get why, based on their lives and their lived experience, they are so moved that they are in the streets right now? Because if you can understand one of the protesters, you can understand 10 of them, and then perhaps you can begin to understand the 10,000.
And Wesley Lowery came to Charlotte because there is a local tie-in to all of this. We had our own riots in the streets in the aftermath of the Keith Lamont Scott shooting last fall. And in that aftermath, which came on the heels of similar encounters around the country, the Levine Museum of the New South has quickly designed and installed an exhibit called No Justice, No Peace. That's with a K-N-O-W. And it runs through October 22nd. Brenda Tyndall is with us. She is the new staff historian at the only the second in the history of the museum, by the way, at the Levine Museum of the New South. And she joins us now along with Alvin Jacobs, the photographer whose work is featured in the exhibit. He traveled the country, too, capturing the protests after officer-involved shootings. Welcome to both of you. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Mike.
Very quickly, because we're short on time in this segment, it takes a long time under normal circumstances for museums to think about, collect artifacts, design an exhibit, and install an exhibit. You did this in a matter of months. How?
Well, we wanted to be responsive to what happened here in our city. And many folks were asking the question, how could this happen in Charlotte? And so we wanted to provide some historical context, but also provide an invitation, hence the term no. K-N-O-W, that's an invitation for community members and stakeholders to come together to understand how Charlotte became sort of a hotbed, if you will, of protests.
Who came up with that? Because that's very clever. No peace, no violence is a slogan that was chanted in the streets with an N. And you added the K to the front of it. So who came up with that?
Well, that was inspired actually by a photograph that Alvin Jacobs had taken where a gentleman was holding a sign that juxtaposed both slogans, no justice with a K and then no justice with an N. And so we thought, given the museum's commitment to using history to build community, that it made sense to really employ the term K. N-O-W as a way to engage our community in this conversation.
When we come back, we'll talk to Alvin because his photographs appear, and I guess they're photographs not just of Charlotte in this museum exhibit, but also of other parts of the country where you've photographed.
Yes, sir.
And they are not your run-of-the-mill photographs. These are really artistic achievements, and we'll talk about that when we come back. And, of course, Wesley Lowery remains with us on the Washington Post. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar. New location now open at The View in downtown Charlotte near BB&T Ballpark. Full portfolio of wine and beer from all over the world, plus live music. Details at thescrewcrew.com. The Trump administration looking to ramp up deportation of illegal immigrants with tough new guidelines that are causing even further alarm and fear in immigrant communities. That's the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point with Tom Ashbrook. Also on the topic of immigration, Charlotte Talks and WFAE are hosting a public conversation next Tuesday when we'll talk about immigration policy and enforcement and its impact on this area's immigrant community. You can get details and register to be there. We'd like you to be there at WFAE.org. We're going to come back more and talk more about the Levine Museum of the New South and their exhibit and how it relates to police shootings around the country in just a moment. Stay with us.
As President Donald Trump settles into the Oval Office, his cabinet nominees face review from Congress.
Because of their companies, because of their lifestyles.
After 20 years of knowing Senator Sessions, I have not seen the slightest evidence.
She is not, so I voted against her. I know we'll vote against every nominee.
NPR will be there through each hearing and appointment with the latest updates and coverage that puts the politics in context. Listen every day.
Stay connected at 90.7 WFAE and at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about police shootings around the country, about the database that the Washington Post has been compiling about all this, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning series of stories they have written about this over the last several years. Wesley Lowery, one of the national reporters involved in that, who also has a book about these shootings called They Can't Kill Us All. He will be in town under the auspices of the Levine Museum on March the 2nd at the Duke Energy Theater to sign this book and to have a discussion about it. But with us in our studio, Brenda Tindall, who is the staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New House in New South, and Alvin Jacobs, a photographer whose work is featured prominently in this latest exhibit called No Justice, No Peace, that runs through October 22nd. Alvin, as a photographer, I'm told that you fell into the role of documenting these protests. You felt yourself being pulled toward these social justice issues following the shooting of Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida in 2014. You photographed the unrest there, in Baltimore, in Brooklyn, in Ferguson, in Chicago, here in Charlotte. How does your work, and I want to hear, because it does, and I just want to hear from you, how does your work as a photographer differ from what we see in the newspaper?
There's one of my favorite quotes in the entire world by Gordon Parks. He said that, "I saw that the camera could be a weapon against poverty, against racism, against all sorts of social wrongs. I knew at that point I had to have a camera." Mm. I have a responsibility. I'm there. I'm present. But I also have a voice. I have an opinion. I have to do something other than spectate. I remember watching some of the live streams in Ferguson, just watching them. And I knew that I was being pulled, I was being drawn, but I'd never been to St. Louis in that capacity a day in my life. I didn't know anyone. I didn't know how I was going to get there. I didn't know how I was going to operate once I arrived. But once I saw the CBS, not the CBS, I'm sorry, that was Baltimore. Once I saw the Quick Trip burn, I just got in the car and started driving. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what my role was going to be. But there was a level of importance and responsibility that came over me that just pushed me forward.
There is a passion in these photographs. That's the best word that I can come up with at the moment. When you look at them, it's not just the people who are you're photographing who do have a passion. That's why they're there.
Absolutely.
But there's a passion that you've captured here that I think might come from you in some way. How do you do that?
You know, no one's ever asked me that, and thank you. I can do more with a photograph than I can with words. When you're asking me a question, I have to think. When I have a camera in my hand, I just do. It's almost a mechanical instinct at this point. I don't worry about shutter speed. I don't worry about depth of field. I don't worry about composition. I shoot, and I know I have what I need. Mm. And I know exactly how I need to process that image to allow the story to unfold. And that was the interesting aspect of it, because I didn't orchestrate anything that I've ever seen. It was already happening. In my opinion, outside of the creative aspect and the art, I just held up a very large and uncomfortably heavy mirror in front of everything that was going on. So I just reflected my environment. I was in the environment by choice oftentimes, but I didn't make any of this up. I didn't tell anyone to do anything. I didn't make anyone do anything. So when people are upset or they're angry, they're frustrated, I understand completely, because I'm angry. I'm frustrated. But we have to realize where this energy is coming from, and it can't come from the inconsistencies in our own character. You can't be upset at me because of what's going on around me. So having a camera gives me the ability to see things and to feel things and to give things.
For a guy who just points and shoots, the quality of your work is cinematic. I mean, you know how to find the light, the right light, because you're not using any unnatural light. It's street lighting. It's
Absolutely.
Lighting from neon signs and store windows that are illuminating these people on the streets here. And it has a cinematic quality to it, which I think brings even more power to it. But you didn't do anything. You just have an eye to find that moment and shoot it. Unlike Wesley Lowery, our guest from the Washington Post, you do not consider yourself to be a journalist. Rather, you've described yourself as an activist with a camera.
Absolutely.
So in that case, aside from artistry, how are you different from every – how are you able to do this? Because there are thousands of people out on the street, all of them carrying a camera in their pocket. They all have iPhones. Mm-hmm. Your pictures are, I don't know, a mile and a half above those,
pictures.
So where does that come from? Is it you've been shooting pictures a long time?
Oh, 6 years.
That's not a long time.
It's not that long. I have a responsibility to the people. I don't think that this is going to be a Pulitzer Prize. I don't think that I'm going to win an award. I don't think that I'm going to receive a platform. My responsibility is to the people in my community, whether it's the community of Brooklyn, the community of Milwaukee, the community of Chicago, the community of Ferguson, of Charleston. I have a responsibility as an artist to deliver a message. So when I'm looking at a particular frame, I already know I have it. And once I process that image, you know, post, you know, we used to use film, you know, back in the day, but I know what I'm going to do to that photo to bring out the elements and the emotions and the feelings that that person was going through. You don't have to even talk to me. A lot of times when I'm photographing, I don't talk to anyone because you're in your element. I understand what you're doing and I'm here for you. I've always been here for the people as far as documenting injustices and documenting protests and documenting uprisings. It's for the people. Someone has to record history.
You could see some of the photographs of by Alvin Jacobs that we're talking about this morning on our website at WFAE.org. Brenda.
Mike, you described Alvin's work as exhibiting passion and a cinematic power, which is in part the reason why we enlisted his, you know, expertise. And I like to think of it as having a certain level of intimacy. In many ways, Alvin, through his photographs, has this uncanny ability to engage sort of the pedestrian contours of the human experience. And that came through in the photographs that were selected as part of No Justice, No Peace. And so the power of those images are just stunning, both to capture the local and the national narrative here.
One of the things that you saw through your lens in Ferguson, you say, was something that you had never seen before, not even in Chicago, and that was militarized police. And you say that seeing that in Ferguson is when you knew you had what it took. What does that mean?
When I first journeyed to Ferguson, the initial night, I didn't, again, know what to expect. But when I saw the people, I got comfortable. When I saw the militarized police, I became uncomfortable. I'm used to seeing police officers in, you know, police officer uniforms, and that really wasn't anything surprising. But when I saw them in the riot gear and when I saw the militarized vehicles, I'd never seen armored vehicles like that before because there really wasn't a place for them. So they weren't tanks, so to speak. You know, they didn't have treads, but they were large vehicles that, I mean, they'd be five, six, seven of them at a time. And when I first arrived, I went to there was this Target parking lot. They were all there. That's where they had all convened. There were school buses full of National Guard members, different members of police forces throughout the state of Missouri. And I'd never seen that amount of law enforcement in one place at one time.
Wesley Lowery from The Washington Post is still with us. And he said, Wesley, Alvin said that when he saw that, he knew that he didn't have the ability to remain neutral. How did you, as a reporter and an African-American, witnessing what Alvin saw in Ferguson, because you were there too, how did you remain neutral?
You know, I think that it is the job of a reporter when we parachute into a story like that to capture most completely and most accurately the story of the people who are in the streets, right? And so for me, I wouldn't be capable of making a secret if I wanted to that I'm a young black man, right? That in many ways, when I saw the pain and anger and confusion of many of the young black men and women who are in the streets, I could relate to them and understand them. Now, it's my job as a reporter to now translate and decipher them to a audience and my audience who perhaps may not understand or be inclined to understand. But I think that humanity as a journalist is something that is an asset to storytelling, like the ability to empathize and sympathize with the people who you are writing about. I think is an important step, because I think that when there, I think that when there is an artificial distance, or in fact a deep distance, if you cannot understand why the people are on the street, if you cannot understand their anger, then you are probably the wrong person to be deciphering that anger to the rest of the nation. Right?
As I said, I have not read your book, but I've read many reviews of your book, and in one of those reviews, it talks about how you write about your struggle as an African American male to discover where you belonged in the Black Lives Matter movement, and to balance that with your being a journalist and your fundamental, this is a quote here, your fundamental professional obligation to fairness and truth. Do you believe you were successful in finding that balance? It's hard.
I do for the most part. It's difficult. Now, one thing, you know, when I have these conversations, you know, I have conversations about things like fairness and truth. I don't have conversations about things like objectivity, which I don't believe exists, right? I think that, and so that, I do differ from some of my colleagues in that space as it relates to kind of what, you know, how I think about this. You know, I think it's my job to be fair to anyone who is linked to a story who I'm writing about. It's my job to be fair in Ferguson. It's my job to be fair to Darren Wilson and fair to his family and fair to the Ferguson police, but also to be fair to the young activist and to the person in the street and to Michael Brown and to Michael Brown's family, right? And I think about, I'm never going to, you know, and I think this is important because we are all humans, right? We all, our lived experiences, our lives color the lenses through which we see the world. And so if you're someone who has felt like they've been racially profiled before, who has experiences with racism and prejudice, who has had perhaps negative experiences, as I have, with police officers, those experiences are certainly going to shape the lens through which I see a story. And I think the only way to begin, for me, challenging myself and making sure that I'm being fair is to acknowledge that that objectivity does not exist. If I were to say, well, but I'm an objective reporter, who cares what my past experiences are? That would, in fact, prevent me from properly interrogating my own potential biases, right? And I think that works in the other direction as well. I think there are a lot of reporters, you know, perhaps who are a few years older than me and with maybe a little less pigment than I do, who have been told their entire career that they are objective. The way they see the world, there's no bias involved in that at all. And I think the reality is we know that no matter what our experiences are, they're going to color the way that we see things. And until we acknowledge that and admit that, we can't even begin the process of correcting for it.
Brenda, a second ago, Wesley was talking about people looking out on the street and saying if they didn't understand why people were protesting, perhaps they shouldn't be the ones covering it. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of people in the aftermath of the riots here in Charlotte who said, what are they out there for? This is not the Charlotte way. This can't happen here. This doesn't happen here. This is not the way we do things. And you've addressed that in this exhibit. Were you surprised that people were saying this is not the way we do it here?
Not necessarily. I mean, Charlotte has a huge transplant population. And so if you haven't been in Charlotte for a long period of time and your purview is, for instance, Center City, then it's very easy to have a very limited understanding of the issues that that plague, if you will, or that inform Charlotte.
Which is why, I think, I'm putting words in your mouth here, but this is why you've put a timeline at the top of this exhibit. It's called From Swan to Scott. Swan,
right,
of course, being Swan versus the Board of Education suit that integrated Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. And Scott, of course, being the Keith Lamont Scott shooting that took place this past fall. So it goes from 1971 to 2016. When you lay it out that way, what do you learn?
I think you learn that some of the issues that have been, you know, that Charlotte has been engaged in since the 60s and 70s are still very much part of our discourse today. And so we can't divorce what's happening in 2016 or 2017 to what has happened in the past. And so it's important to have some context for why our city responded in the way that it did, and why the nation is responding. Our timeline actually covers both local and national history. So Charlotte isn't understood in a vacuum, that Charlotte may indeed be understood as a microcosm of what's happening on the national stage.
But it could be argued that 1971 is a false place to start, that maybe you ought to go back to the 1600s.
We've thought about that. But one of the things that, I think starting with From Swan to Scott does is it provides roughly a 45, 50-year understanding of Charlotte. We've done an excellent job through our Cotton Fields the Skyscraper exhibit of really looking at the period from 1865 through the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, this Swan to Scott timeline makes an important intervention in the story of the New South.
Alvin Wesley, Alvin talks about feeling a responsibility to document these protests around the country with his camera. You've covered all of these incidences, Wesley, for the Washington Post. You've personalized your experiences doing so in your book. Has this begun to feel like a responsibility to you as well?
You know, I think it did for a long time feel like a responsibility. But I think that I've got a clarity, and I had this as I began working on the book, that this is not a responsibility that I will carry with me forever. I will not always be the person who covers policing. I will not always be the person who covers protests. Because the reality is, as you guys were just talking about, this is the themes and the underlying issues as it relates to this conversation stretch back to the 1600s and very likely are going to stretch forward.
And I'm going to have to cut you off there. I'm sorry, but we're completely out of time. Wesley Lowery from the Washington Post will be in Charlotte on the 2nd of March to talk about his book and sign it at 5:30 at the Duke Energy Theater under the auspices of the Levine Museum of the New South. Brenda Tindall is the staff historian there. Alvin Jacobs' work as a photographer at these various protests around the country is featured, and you can see some of that work right now at wfae.org/charlottetalks. Better yet, go to the museum and see it up close.